changing her environment, right? And let's just say her body begins to respond.
Okay.
And then the cancer begins to diminish.
But that's not what
you're
doing.
And the more new information she has, the more she transforms her body.
Spirit. That's right? Not what you're doing, engaged in, though. What you're doing is patient A goes to the physician and is diagnosed with cancer. And patient A says, I have cancer, and the way I'm going to respond to this cancer is succumb to it. Patient B goes to the doctor and says, and the doctor diagnoses, hey, we've diagnosed you with cancer. Patient B says, I have cancer, and the way I'm going to respond to this is to seek holistic treatment, transform my life, transform my environment, and do everything I can to purge these cancer cells from my body. Now, what you do is an example of what you do is patient B goes to the doctor, and the doctor says, you have cancer, and patient B says, no, I don't. I'm not going to claim cancer. I'm not going to acknowledge
exactly.
Cancer. And that's worse than patient
that
A.
That is me.
Now,
yes.
What
that
patient
is me.
But that's not but what you said patient did is I acknowledge this unfavorable condition and I'm going to take a proactive stance to correct it. So you can acknowledge that you're a victim and then take proactive steps to address it. You're
and
denying that you're a
you
victim.
Could.
You're not acknowledging,
absolutely.
Hey, I have cancer. And I need to make some changes to address this cancer. I need to acknowledge the cancer, embrace the fact that
I have cancer. That's your process.
Except
I didn't ever say anything about acknowledging. I said one person got certain information, got with the C word, which is in our culture usually equals death, and another person got the same diagnosis. You receive the same diagnosis.
Do you accept the
right?
diagnosis? Do you acknowledge
you receive the
diagnosis?
You'd accept it. One person accepted it. The other person did not accept it.
The person did
you
accept it.
You have to
it.
Deny. There's a level Spirit. Of this that, like I said, this is not the right platform because it takes a lot of time to really go into. But you have to deny that.
Spirit.
I remember interviewing in my radio show. I interviewed people who had healed from all kind of illnesses. Breast cancer, cervical cancer.
Wait.
Pancreas cancer.
Did the people who healed themselves from breast cancer acknowledge that they had breast cancer?
Well, they were on the show. They told me they had it.
Oh, so they acknowledged
what I'm saying
that
they
acknowledged
process,
that
they
had
denied,
a disease. They acknowledged.
I'm sorry?
They acknowledged that they had cancer.
They were told they had cancer.
Did they say accept
right?
that? Did they accept that?
I didn't ask that specific question. They did not accept they had cancer.
Then why would you, how can they be on your show talking about being healed from a condition that they never had?
Because you're saying is you got a diagnosis. They
yes.
never accepted the outcome. They
did
never
they
accepted.
After they received the diagnosis, did they make any changes in their lives?
They healed from cancer.
They didn't
changed.
Have cancer. How are you going to heal from something you didn't have? You got a bunch of con artists on your show. They say, I never had cancer, therefore I hear I've never been diagnosed with cancer.
No, you see, now you're taking, you're playing with it.
No,
see,
I'm not.
Because you want to try to make a point. What I am saying is they had a diagnosis. They were given a diagnosis.
And they rejected
Lisa
it.
Lisa did something different to with the diagnosis. And then Mary did something totally different. And what I'm saying is that's how I see how my mind works. You say we're a victim. I don't see it that way. I see all the ways in which we can get new information, whether it's higher or whatever word you want to use, creative, and make choices to heal ourselves.
Heal from what? We're not victims. What are we going to heal ourselves from? You said make choices
just
to heal ourselves. How can we be healing?
You want to own it. You can have a problem and not be the problem. See, we want to own everything. It's our woundology. We exist through our wounds. You can say I have a problem. Like I don't have any money in my bank.
How can you deny disease and victimhood, but you talk healing? What are people healing from if not their victimization and their disease? What are they healing from if they never had the disease and they never been victims? What are you healing people from?
The congruency within them, the congruency, the lack of congruency within themselves.
What is congruent? What does that mean?
Meaning that their own alignment with their own power. And that's why I guess we're kind of conflicting on this whole victim thing, because it's not it's just not how I see it. So for example, if we were to take Lisa and Mary, my mentoring is about helping both of them to be able to see there's options. that they that there this is this has a greater story for you. This in this diagnosis is power, is an opportunity to show your power or tap into your power.
By rejecting the diagnosis.
Absolutely.
So if you reject
rejecting the prognosis and the diagnosis, because they say cancer, right? When you say cancer, people think death. But what is cancer?
Cancer is the unregulated mm-hmm. reproduction of cells. That's all it is.
That's all it is.
Yes.
Right. So the agreement that we have with the word cancer is not what it really is. It's really the body's intelligence trying to, the tumor is these, it's the body trying to keep these cells together, which causes a tumor. It's trying to prevent these cells from running rapid throughout the body.
Well, that depends
which causes
if it's a benign or metastatic tumor. You have benign tumors and you have metastatic tumors. And it depends on the nature of the cancer and the overall homeostasis of the person who's being diagnosed. I have another question. If these people are not going to claim to diagnose, why even go to the doctor to be diagnosed? Why even go to the doctor? Why was this person
there you go. See, that you're trying to sell the whole thing. Thing. What I'm saying is you acknowledge an issue. You can acknowledge that I'm feeling pain. You can acknowledge that maybe I stumped my toe. Or you can acknowledge these things, but how you identify which makes a difference.
Right. I acknowledge that I'm a victim, and my response to my victim status is to be a revolutionary Pan-Africanist and organize with my other conscious black people in order to dismantle the systems and institutions that oppress me and my people.
Awesome.
But the only reason I do this is because I am a victim. I have been done an injustice, an ancestral, inherited injustice. I was born into injustice. So even after I was born and everything in my life has been wonderful and I hit the numbers, I got lottery, I got money and things, I would still be a revolutionary and I would put all my resources and talents to the revolution because of my victim status that I inherited from past generations and that I, through no fault of my own, am passing down to my descendants. But I am a victim. That motivates me. And it empowers me to have an accurate understanding of my status because then I can implement a treatment or a cure for the disease that has been accurately diagnosed. But denying the reality of what I am totally obstructs, if not completely prevents me from addressing or curing what my problem is.
Well, again... This is a man who was diagnosed with cancer. He was given, he wrote a book, had like 3 or 6 months to live. And he was like, okay, I'm just going to. He went and he ran up all his credit cards. And he said, I'm going to live my life. I'm just going to live my life. Do what I want to do. Mm. He said he had like maybe $80,000 in debt. But his cancer went away. It just went away when he shifted something in his mindset and he began to go on that trajectory of what his soul was really wanting to experience in life, right? And then he came back, he had all this debt, and then he sued the credit companies. It's like, hey, you knew I didn't have any money. It's kind of funny. But that's the whole point, you see? So there's different ways to solve a problem. And I think you have your way, and that's great. And I'm not saying that's bad or wrong for you. I love it.
I don't think that's the only way. Right. There are different ways, but each of those different mm-hmm. ways fall into only two categories, effective and ineffective.
Absolutely.
So even though I have my way, you have your way, both of our separate divergent ways fall in one of two boxes. It will be either be effective or ineffective.
Absolutely. I definitely agree with you. And as I look back as to what, the strategies of I would say, over the past, say, 60 years or so, right? If you begin to look at that, and there's so much to this that I want to go into, but if you look at 60 years for us, the past 60 years in our culture and fighting for rights and then the Pan-African movement, how are you going to measure its effectiveness? How do you measure it? Yeah, I measure it when
easy.
The problem is no longer there, when the cancer is gone, right?
Okay.
How do you measure it?
Do measure cancer or Pan-African progress?
Yeah, Pan-African progress.
The way I measure Pan-African progress is I look at the goals and objectives of the ideology and the movement, and I look at how close or far we are to the goals and objectives of the movement. And I also have to look at how the people have held to the goals and objectives. Now, I have found that when African people have been consistently, and not even the masses, but if a statistically relevant number of African people adhere to the tenets, the principles, and the agenda of Pan-Africanism, we have progressed. When we have diverged from that, we have regressed. Now, history is not a current, you know, with this fairy tale thing where history, as time goes on, things will get better. People regress in history, people progress in history, and people stagnate. So we have had times of progress, we have had times of regression, and we have times of stagnation. And in that time, as a revolutionary Pan-Africanist, when we are at, depending on when there is progress, I have to work to accelerate and sustain it. When we are regressing, I have to work to stop the regression. When we are stagnant, I have to advocate that we progress again. So it, depending on what time, whether I was organizing in the civil rights era, the Garvey era, the Black Power era, and the pre-colonial, post-colonial, depending on what era of Pan-Africanism. But I also have one other caveat. When we look at Western intelligence agencies and Western imperial institutions, they fear Pan-Africanism and have put more resources to subverting Pan-Africanism than almost any other kind of black movement, social movement. Even militant armed movements that aren't Pan-Africanist are less of a threat than Pan-African peace nonviolent movements. So I not only get confirmation from my own history, I also get confirmation of the efficacy and the threat that Pan-African poses to the Western paradigm by their own actions and their own documents. And I say now we are in a time of progress, but the progress needs to be accelerated. That's all. And intensified and refined. But it's scientific. It's not about higher or lower thoughts. It's about, you know, cold, scientific, unglamorous, no bells, whistles, or incense smoke. Just cold, cogent analysis.
Well, that's where we agree, but I do think we need access to new thoughts. And
accurate
creative
thoughts,
I should say.
Accurate
yes.
thoughts. There are no
access to... Yeah, creative ideas, because basically, you know, I've been in the Pan-African movement for a very long time. And just in the grassroots level, the redundancy of ideas.
Oh, yes.
It's like there's nothing. Yeah, so the redundancy of ideas, it's like there's no growth. Where's
yes.
expansion? Where's evolution?
That's that, you know, stagnation. I agree that there is a lot of stagnation. But there's also a lot of... There, stagnation is a persistent problem with any multi-generational movements. Whenever you have a movement that spans several generations and several decades and it spans continents and geography, you're going to have times of stagnation. That should be prepared for and understood. But there's other things entering and contaminating the struggle. And so I think esotericism is also a bigger problem than... stagnation. There's a lot of, you know, shaman and wizards and magical beings and magical thoughts that have come into the struggle that have black people thinking that there's some supernatural element to this struggle. And there's a lot of resources, time, and energy put into supernatural aspects of the struggle that I don't think, like you had said earlier, bear any fruit for us.
Well, again, we have to measure that. So we have to measure that. And I do think that I'm a scientist. And I think that as a scientist, so far as a life scientist, I do see life a little differently, you know, and then I get different outcomes based on how I see it. Mm. So I'm excited because of the research about the brain. The science, I'm sure you would love that about the brain and how we actually can affect change in our own personal life and affect our families. Because the thing is, we talk a lot about the community and the larger community, but if we don't have strong family institutions, I don't want to use strong families, I should say, not institutions, strong families, connections, and community, if we're not really elevating our children and having loving relationships, then, which is what I'm about,
but strong
then how
family,
do you ever get to the point where you have loving, whole communities?
But I came from a very weak family, and my siblings have a college degree, master's, entrepreneurs. I'm probably the only, you know, sad failure in the family, but the rest of them went on to full ride college scholarships, civil servants, home ownership, stable marriages, all that good stuff. And I came from a relatively weak family by the standards, you know, of the nuclear family concept. So I'm not really sure.
Yeah, but you saying that does not take into consideration all the varied ways in which it has affected you and your siblings. You know, like they went to college, okay, like so what? I mean, that's great. But what about how do they treat people?
They're fairly decent.
What's their self-perception? What's their self-esteem so far as many different areas of their lives?
Well, in the terms of strong families, though, do you mean the nuclear family unit?
I'm saying a loving family environment where we are actually evolving our children to be geniuses, because they have access to solutions we may not have. Like my niece grew up, she's like 15, right? So she is so far more advanced with technology than I am. I mean, and her creative ways of what she brings to the family with her ideas is really valuable. And she's an avid reader also, right? So if our children aren't cultivated, right, then we end up saying, okay, yeah, these children these days, they doing this and they doing that. We want to blame the children. But it's up for this generation to set the example, to set the standard, to create these infrastructures where the next generations can come through and faster than we collapse time and get there faster than what we did.
Well, again, I don't think that, to go back to the notion, how do we get there? How do we create these little geniuses and then make sure that these little geniuses don't go work for Halliburton? They don't go to work for Bechtel. They don't go to work for Raytheon. They don't go to work for the Pentagon. So creating geniuses is one thing because, you know, I personally know scientists. I personally know engineers, and all of them pretty much work for our oppressors. And they produce.
We don't
more
have
for
the infrastructure to,
exactly.
To, like, for example, what will we do with the
right? So creating geniuses is just one aspect of it.
They're already geniuses. We're not creating geniuses. They already are geniuses. We're cultivating it. So
okay,
they
cultivating
can bring
geniuses
forth their gifts.
Is just one aspect of it.
Absolutely. This is a multifaceted experience.
Yes.
There's not one magic bullet.
Yes.
And yes, if, that's and, that
and,
what
and
I do,
doing
though.
One thing superbly while failing to do the other things will pretty much send you backwards. You know, we've got black scientists designing guidance systems for U.S. drones and U.S. Intercontinental missiles. That's
right.
What black scientists, black geniuses are up to. To me, that's not really genius, though. You know, that's technical skills, but that's not genius.
Genius has many different, you know, expressions. So
I don't think so. No, I don't think so.
Yeah, you could be genius. Yeah, genius are different expressions. They're all not just working for Halliburton. They're genius. There's different ways you can express your own genius. And every child has something that they can express and they can contribute. And it's really cultivating that and helping them to guide them to that. Because that's why they're here, to contribute on some level, yes? I mean, it may be esoteric for you.
Some people don't contribute. Some people come to the world to extract.
I mean, we both are broadcasting and receiving information. We both have come to a duality, to not only the experience, but to who we are as well.
Right.
Of course, we all are extracting and giving also.
Right.
But there's a reason, purpose why they're here. So if that genius is to extract, okay, then let's get them cultivated for that. Let's get their mind and their bodies and their souls, in their psyche prepared for that, if you will.
Mm. Well, I mean, to me, it's because to me, I think the black family, in terms of strong families, I think that kind of sets us up in a trap, because
I said loving families. That's the word I use.
Loving families. Well, I mean, most families. I mean, that's kind of I suppose, because I mean, let me not even assume that families are inherently loving, because I mean, and nowadays, because of alienation, there is a great absence of love. But I really do appreciate this opportunity to dialogue, because I really think that we also like to get into bubbles, and we can't really engage people we have divergent positions with in a respectful and constructive manner. So, you know, even if I'm not going to go get you to go and acknowledge your victimhoods, or you're not going to get me to meditate or try to elevate or get to higher frequencies, even though, I mean, I think it's good, because we're all part of the same struggle and same community. But and let's get to where you had mentioned earlier, if we could take it all the way back to sexuality. And now we have black folks being a subculture or a subordinate population over these insane Yorugus, you know, these Howleys, these Europeans who one just a few months ago they elected a sexual predator as their president, and now they want to, you know, get rid of every sexual and hunting, and there's a great witch hunt and revival of the woman, you know. So it's madness. They go, because this is a pendular society. It goes from one extreme to the next. There's no balance. There's no stability. It just swings one way and it swings the other. So you can go from Sodom and Gomorrah to puritanical, you know, chasteness. So, but us, we who are on the other side of this, how do we begin to move towards? Say, because I have brothers tell me, how am I supposed to find me a good woman if I can't even, now I feel like I can't even walk up to a sister. Now, I think that's nonsense.
Because of the harassment?
They say that, right. They say that's idiot because they can't talk to a woman in the streets, or they don't even know if or how to approach a strange woman, because everything is so interpreted as an assault or sexual violence. And on the other side of that, how do black women in particular, because white women ain't playing no games. White women are like, right now, you notice when they got rid of Charlie Rose, it was two white women sitting in that chair. You know, they just got rid of Matt Lauer, and now this white woman taking that position. White women, because black people, because a sister told me the Me Too movement, a black woman told me the whole Me Too movement is about women being heard. And I'm like, white women don't care about being heard. They're about, give me my cut of the resources. Give me my control of the institutions. I want power. I want money. I want standing. Whereas black women, I'm just hearing, I just want to be heard. You know, so how do black women begin to understand that they need to take power? This is a power resource, and this is a power struggle. This is a research struggle. It's not just a treat me right, do right by me struggle.
Ooh. Well, yeah. there's definite need for women to be vulnerable and share, because it's like what the Black Lives Movement, the name itself, I always had an issue with when it first came out, like Black Lives Matter. And so I think what women are basically saying is like, I, you know, I matter, right? And these things have been happening to me. And most women hold a lot of shame and a lot of guilt regarding their sexual abuse. I was, do you know Iyanla Van Zandt?
Yes.
I was at an event of hers, and it was a moment where this young lady was in a lot of pain. She had gone through a lot of pain regarding her mother's boyfriend, sexual abuse. And then through the process, she asked the women in the group, like, how many women here have been sexually abused? And I turned around to see how many women were standing up and raising their hands. It was almost the entire room, right? And so what what she brought this, us to this process of reclaiming our wombs, if you will, about taking back the power from what someone's done in you and understanding who you are fundamentally as a woman. It was a very powerful experience. And so I don't want to diminish that women being heard, because it goes back to the intimacy. Like, some men don't want us to, some women, some people in general have a hard time with intimacy, because they say, okay, this is happening to me. Well, get over it. You know, I mean, say, you know, I went to work and this guy, he touched my butt. That's it? That's all he did? You know, it's like, you know, you can't really share and be vulnerable about how I felt, how it made me feel. And even be lovingly held through that process to let it go. Because you don't have a voice. And when you don't have, so you have a voice, you don't feel you have value. You don't feel your thoughts, your ideas matter. So I don't want to diminish that. The women who were authentically trying to communicate with that movement.
So they're saying being heard is adequate for Black women.
I think because we don't really have a voice. The reason why white women don't need a voice, because their male counterpart has created infrastructure for them, right?
Right.
To thrive. Well, in their offspring.
Wait,
right?
A second.
So they
Right. So you, because like I said, Black women are talking to, or have said to me, the few that I've spoke to, and mm-hmm. These are engaged women. These are active revolutionary women engaged in the struggle. These aren't just, you know, just. Okay.
Lower women.
Or women who are just women on the streets. These are women who are engaged academically, uh-huh. socially, culturally, politically. They said, okay. This is about us hearing our voice. The Me Too is about getting out our voice.
Mm-hmm.
You said white women don't need to do that. Black women need to do that, whereas white women don't, because white women, because white men and white people have infrastructure and power. And because we lack infrastructure and power, mm-hmm. we just can settle on just, we're lucky to get our voices heard. So But my whole mm-hmm. point was that white women are about getting more power within the infrastructure that they've built and gaining greater control of the resources that they've stolen. So in order to make your voice heard, it's going to require institutional power and control over resources.
Well, no, I'm talking about, see, there's different, let's start with layer one, right?
Uh-huh.
So suppose you had an experience and you not voicing it is causing you some turmoil. It's like you feel more anxious, more pain, you're frustrated. You may not have shared your story. You may have suppressed it or repressed it.
Uh-huh.
And you have an opportunity now to share your story. This has happened to me. Just to clear it out of you, right?
Yes.
That's like level one. That's like the very personal part of it.
And then what?
And then when you begin to share the things you're shameful about yourself, you take that off your soul. You take the weight off of you, right? And you can be a little bit more free. Because these women, I want to talk about this too, because this is what I talk about, womb trauma. Women who are sexually abused in their offspring, right? We transfer that to our children unknowingly, right? So right now, it's like so many young people are going through depression, the suicidal thoughts, suicide ideation, homicidal ideation. Psychotropic drugs are just this is crazy right now. Like, I'm getting more inboxes about my son is depressed or suicidal than I am about my fitness training program, right? This is really real. And I'm seeing the connection between sexual trauma and then these issues in the children, right? So this is, like, so important for her to take the shame off of her and take the guilt off of her, because she's the mother, and you know, and if she transfers those feelings, that low self esteem to her children, then that child's going to have issues being highly productive in society. So this is really the meat and bones of it, if you ask me. It's like right here in the womb, before the child's even conceived, because all the thoughts, all the blood chemistry is passed through the placenta. So this child is taking in and inheriting the mother's mindset and how she feels about herself. And if she's gone through some sexual abuse, well, she hasn't been able to clear that out of herself, then that child is going to hold those patterns until someone interrupts it generationally. Have you known that a lot of women who are sexually abused were sexually abused? They've been sexually abused for generations. A lot of women who've been raped have been raped generationally. It's like a pattern. It's like a mental, emotional pattern in the family. And so we have to interrupt that now. Those of us who have been abused, have been molested, been raped, we have to take responsibility that it's up to us now to end the pattern so our daughters and granddaughters and nieces and nephews can no longer have the experience.
Right. And how do we end the pattern? How do we stop that?
The patterns in the family is the mindset. Right? It's the inherited mindset. So it's being clear. I always ask women to find out the womb that you came out of. Talk to your mother about her sexual experiences. A lot of women have been raped and you don't even know.
Because right? They're not so claiming their victimhood. They're rejecting their victimhood.
However you want to call it, they feel shame about the experience. Shame and guilt about the self-judgment about the experience.
Because we shame victims and we tell people, don't be a victim. You can't be a victim. You reject victimhood. Don't claim that title. Don't say that word.
Well, you can share your experience and not see yourself as a victim. But I don't want to continue that because I think that misses the point. Because, forgot what I was going to say. But the point is that women, like, talk to your women in your family. Talk to your aunts about their love relationships, how they connect. Begin to write it down and see the pattern in your own family dynamic. You know, talk about the abuse. Talk about it all. You know, have tea time. Have some tea or have some whatever time, a circle time in your family. Create a sacred circle within the women in your family. And begin to talk about these things and bring them out. And the more we talk about it, the more we get it out, we clear, do some African dancing, do some rituals and some clearing techniques that we can talk about. But it has to be, you have to act against the paradigm, right? And if you really begin to go into deep, that there's some real issues at the core of self-esteem and self-worth, at the core of it all. You know, and we've been transferring over to our daughters and our sons. Yeah. So get to know, get intimate with the womb that created you. Get intimate with your aunts and your grandmother about men and life and how they saw themselves, their sense of beauty. Did they wear wigs? You know, why did they wear wigs? Like my grandmother, she passed, and she had a very negative opinion about my skin color. You know, she told my mom, like, she said, your kids look like they've been burned in a fire. So that's what came out of my grandmother, right? Mm. So that was her mindset.
Right.
So my mother had the same, the different mindset, but my grandmother married someone who was lighter, a little bit lighter, and had different color daughters. One daughter happened to be very dark skin, and she was treated very differently than my mom and my other aunt. See, and then my aunt, I didn't know this until 2 years ago because this aunt had passed, but I didn't know how much she felt alienated in her own family because of her skin color. I had no clue. This came up because of our daughters were talking about it. I'm like, okay, you have to know what's going on.
and to understand all of this is black people to have this intense internal dysfunction is necessary in order to sustain the global power hierarchy. If black people did not have such dysfunctional attitudes and behaviors, then a white minority could not control us as individuals or control our territories and extract our resources. So like you said, there's a source to all this, and there's even a rationale and a scientific purpose to all of this. So and that's why, and my point, and that's why we need accurate diagnosis, and it is personal. But in order to construct a viable solution, we have to depersonalize this and look at it as a systemic issue, as a structural issue, and come up with revolutionary and scientific solutions.
Awesome.
Because if we just keep looking at the individual level, there's billions of African people with this dysfunction, and we don't have the time. The earth doesn't have the time. The world's ecosystems doesn't have the time for us to do this on a person-to-person or even a family-by-family basis. Not saying that that work on an individual shouldn't be done, but we find out that in when we look at societies that engage in revolutionary struggle, whenever you find a people organized for revolutionary struggle, you find a renaissance of self-acceptance, a renaissance of the culture, of the natural aesthetics. When we were fighting the system, we didn't just take up arms to rebel against the system. That's when the Afro came back. That's when Black is Beautiful. The cultural and the aesthetic renaissance was a byproduct of the political and economic rebellion. And that's been the same across cultures. You find that people begin to oppressed people begin have a whole cultural and even some would say spiritual renaissance when they engage in the political and economic resistance.
And it takes esteem to do that. So like when Marcus Garvey came over here, he said, you know, he looked for the leader, but he thought about himself enough to say, I'll be that leader. You know, you have to have something inside of you to have a Marcus Garvey, to birth a movement the way he did. You see what I'm saying? So I do think the personal work is extremely important because the person is the collective.
Yes, and the personal work can only be done through engaging the collective because, again, an individual is just a unit of a whole. So the only way to work on yourself and to know and to measure the progress of your work is by engaging with other people around you. Because if it's just you isolated, how do you know whether you're moving forward or backwards? How do you orient yourself?
Absolutely. We need relationships, right?
Yes.
So we need relationships.
Productive, functional, healthy, mutually beneficial relationships.
Yeah, but we need relationships to determine, like, this process. Where am I in my own personal evolution, right?
Yes.
You know, am I being abused? Am I being, you know, talked down to? Am I tolerating any abuse? Am I tolerating and allowing certain things in my space?
Right.
You know, oh, okay, I got to change this. I got to change that. And this is data.
Yes.
It's data that we can use to go within and say, okay, what's going on?
Yes.
Okay. Let me shift this. Let me do this. Let me make adjustments to my own stuff so I can get a different outcome.
Right. Yeah, and I think in this era of acknowledgement, because it's not as though this is a new thing that's happening, I really would like for Black women to really give a lot of attention to securing and negotiating for power and resources. Because, again, that's what white women are doing. White women are just not trying to be heard or just want justice. They want power and resources. They've kind of oriented us to think about, we want justice, we want equality, and we want some favorable regulations, and we want, you know, new laws written, and we're still impoverished. After all that good stuff comes down the pipe, we're still impoverished and in the same socioeconomic position that we were before the Great Awakening. So in this era of Great Awakening, say, no, we need to negotiate for some power. We need some Black women in positions of power. And as Black white men and Black men are taken from positions of power for acts of sexual harassment and other lascivious acts, we want Black women specifically to be given those powers and Black women of a specific ideological orientation to be given power. And as those men are having to give up resources as a result, as punishment for those crimes, we want some of those resources to be put in the direct hands of Black women of a specific ideological orientation. Because that's what happens when there is a crime. That's reparations. It's not just about, I want my voices to be heard. I want what's been done to be acknowledged. And I want new laws and regulations. And then so but that doesn't really change lives as much as here's some positions, here's some control, here's some resources. Now you can create the reality as opposed to hoping that we do better in the future. You can create the better reality on your own, independent.
Yes, and I just want to say this because, you know, I have to. again, there's a manufactured aspect to the media is manufactured. So most of what you see on the television is not really real. It's distorted at best.
Yes.
But a lot of it's completely manufactured. So when you see on television, they give you the projection of someone losing power. That's not the case, because or losing positions or you think someone's getting fired per se, right? Or you think someone is going to jail for some type of crime, white collar crime, if you will. Know that all the time, that's not the case. So again, it's only six or seven corporations that run this thing. Everything from media to print, the books that you have access to, et cetera. So they run this a tight, very well tight run system where these six corporations run it all.
Right. That's definitely another part of the discussion. You know, the nature of power and who's really in control. But I know we pretty covered a spectrum. I'm very happy that you agreed to come on the show. I really appreciate your perspective, which is something quite new for the Bro Diallo show, if you've heard past shows. So I do appreciate you, but I'm at the time where I have to get ready for Band Nation to come on next. Q4 Radio, AM 1680 in the city of Chirac and the state of Drillinoid. And Spirit Halima, can you give your, before you go off the air, can you give your contact information for our listeners in case they want to send you more requests or find out how they can get access for your services?
Oh, sure. They can reach me at my website, which is spirithalima.com. That's spirit, H-A-L-I-M-A.com. They can also find me on Instagram or Facebook at Spirit Halima.
Yes, and you can go to the Bro Diallo blog, Bro Diallo website, and social media, and I will also be posting the Spirit Halima site so you can get it there if you didn't get it here. And you will find this show posted on the Bro Diallo archive sooner than later. Again, thanks for tuning in to the Bro Diallo show, and thank you again, Sister Spirit Halima.
Thank you.
All right, sis.